Hi, this is John Udall. In this week's episode of Perspectives, we'll hear about the Worldwide Telescope from project leader Curtis Wong, manager of Next Media Research at Microsoft, and Rory Gould, a science educator at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. We'll hear first from Curtis Wong, who recalls how his early interest in astronomy was thwarted because he grew up in Los Angeles, not being able to see the stars.
I've always been interested in astronomy as a kid. And I grew up in Los Angeles, and I remember reading a lot of books about astronomy in elementary school, and I'd sort of read about the Milky Way, but when you grow up in Los Angeles, the odds of seeing the Milky Way are pretty rare. In fact, I think the only time people have seen the Milky Way was during the 89 earthquake recently when all the power went out in the whole city. But So in Los Angeles, I used to wonder about the Milky Way, but never really saw it. And it wasn't until much later, and after high school, actually, until I first saw it. And so, being under a night sky, especially, I went to an observing site where the LA Astronomical Society has a number of telescopes, and amateurs go up there with telescopes, and it was a star party. And that was the first time I really sort of saw the Milky Way and saw a lot of objects that I've seen pictures of in telescopes. And it was really quite a transformative experience. And so it was something that I always wanted to try and figure out how to recreate and share that experience. And so later on, I think during the 80s, I worked at the Voyager company, but prior to that, I used to mess around with HyperCard, and I made a little HyperCard stack that I called Mac Telescope. I'm not sure this has ever been talked about this anywhere, but it essentially was my attempt to try and recreate this experience of what it's like to kind of look at the sky, and if you can manage to see the Milky Way, to sort of zoom in to a section of the Milky Way in the south, and there's all these interesting sort of globular clusters and nebulae and things like that are there if you know where to look.
Yeah, so there was already really the idea of taking people on a guided tour.
Exactly. And sort of giving them this context of there in the sky are some familiar markers, which are constellations, but there's a lot of interesting things going on in there. And so that was a little HyperCard stack that I did. And so after leaving the Voyager company, I went to a company called Continuum, which was a little think tank organization that was started by Bill Gates, and went to work there. And The company that was thinking about authoring tools and media and things like that, and it was actually an interesting company because Fortune had done a magazine article called, I think it was 25 Cool Companies to Work For, and the Voyager company where I worked before was one of those, and Continuum was also another one of those companies too. And at that company, we were thinking about not only authoring tools, but maybe that we should create a real project and sort of with the tools that either we were thinking of or existing tools, just to try out some ideas. And so the project that I thought of was this project called John Dobson's Universe. And for people in the amateur astronomy community, John Dobson is kind of a really interesting character, and that he was a physical chemist that was at UC Berkeley before the war, and sort of got drafted to work on the Manhattan Project. And he was there to do the chemistry for tubuloy, which was the code name for a uranium alloy that was going to be going into the bomb. And so he became a conscientious objector, and after several days of interviewing with the FBI, they finally let him out of the program, which was pretty hard to do back then because he knew a lot, and became a Vedantin monk. And in the process of that, I think he became very interested in the sky from having looked at a telescope for the first time. But in being a monk, he didn't have any money. So in San Francisco, he remembered coming across these salvage yards, these round discs of glass about 8 to 10 inches in diameter that were fairly thin, maybe about a half inch. And the conventional wisdom at that time was that you need really thick glass to be able to grind a mirror out of. And he defied wisdom and tried to grind a mirror out of that thin porthole glass, and he was able to actually make a telescope out of that. And he came up with an ingenious way of mounting the telescope using cardboard sonotubes, you know, that form concrete.
Sure.
And his design for the balanced mount is called a Dobsonian mount in his name, although he didn't name it after himself. But anyway, it's one of the most common designs for telescope mounts in the world. And he also started an organization called San Francisco Sidewalk Astronomers, where people that have telescopes are encouraged to take them out into the public and show people what's up in the sky and explain what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So John spent a lifetime in national parks and in San Francisco talking about astronomy to the public. And the reason why I wanted to use him was he was really, really good at taking complex ideas and really helping convey those ideas to the public. Like, I remember he was showing in the Andromeda Galaxy, and there was a picture of the Andromeda Galaxy, and you see the galaxy in the background, which looks like this kind of fog, and then you see all these stars in front. And he would say, like, the stars that you're looking at in front are like raindrops on your window looking at a distant cloud. And then you, oh, wow. I mean, little things like that, I think, help convey context for the public. And so that was a project we had started and got about, halfway through building a prototype. And then some other things happened and that project got canceled. So I've always thought about astronomy for a long time. And at Microsoft, I was working with, I actually heard a talk by Jim Gray.
I went back and looked up a paper that Jim published with a guy from Johns Hopkins, Alex Zale. And it's called The Worldwide Telescope. Interestingly, the title also includes the phrase, an archetype for online science. And the point is that not just in astronomy, but essentially in all of science now, we're getting to the point where there's going to be less direct observation and there's going to be more collection and analysis of data at a really large scale, and that's going to be happening, you know, in ways that are computationally assisted and also are assisted by the collaborative properties of the internet, right? So he was thinking about this as you know, not even just an astronomical project, but as a model for really sort of all of science as it moves into an electronically mediated mode.
Exactly. The Silicon Revolution, with the declining cost and the greater size and resolution of sensors, is transforming astronomy, just like digital photography. But the cheap sensors are also being much, much more widely used in other science disciplines. And so we're getting this deluge of data. And so the challenge then becomes how you process, how you utilize this mountain of data. And I think bringing computer technologies to it, either SQL or other kinds of visualization technologies, can really help. And so Jim had written that paper with Alex in 2002, and he had given a talk about some of the work that he was doing with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey at that time.
Yeah, I've actually heard that talk, and so I was hoping that you could help me connect the dots between the work that was done there for SkyServer and for this federated virtual observatory, which for him also became a kind of a case study in the use of XML web services to knit together a bunch of loosely coupled services across the internet.
Exactly.
In this case, really to create a kind of an internet telescope that was a federation of radio astronomy services.
That's exactly right. So Jim had written that paper, and Alex and several other research scientists had come together to try and put together what essentially is a national virtual observatory effort, which is sort of a federation of trying to establish common protocols from which to be able to access astronomical data and imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And that NVO organization had its early starts there in those days.
Mm-hmm.
After hearing Jim's talk, I was, one of the challenges with doing the astronomy project that I wanted to do was, of course, access to large amounts of sky data.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he told me that they were starting to do that project, I said, well, you know, let me know how I can help in any way on that project. And Jim was aware of some other educational and interactive projects that I had done, because part of that pitch to him was I sent him a PowerPoint that I created about SkyServer, but not just having data and images, but taking that information and providing a building a virtual environment with that data, because I think what they were thinking of was for astronomers to be able to, you know, directly go into databases anywhere and pull out an image of an object. And I said, you know, that's just the start to me. I think what to make this a really interesting educational resource is we need to create an environment where we can allow people to create and share stories within this environment that's very, very rich, both in imagery, but also the objects in those within that environment are then connected to original source information.
Mm-hmm.
After I had talked to Jim about what I wanted to do, he came back to me later and said, you know, we've released SkyServer the data, and he said, what I'd really like is for you to help us redesign our website, the data, sort of more accessible to the public. So I helped do that. So SkyServer DR2, Data Release 2, was a redesigned website.
Okay.
And that's when I also really pushed to try and build the case for this, building this larger environment for learning with Worldwide Telescope.
And under the covers at SkyServer, there was a substantial amount of data integration that was happening,
yeah.
Right? Now there's these, you know, as I understand it, a lot of the work that was done was in order to be able to correlate observations from multiple data sets and, you know, bring them together in a context.
Exactly.
Okay.
And Alex Olay did a lot of that work in collaboration with some other universities as well.
So that's all foundational for what we see now.
It was sort of the first case, which is the Sloan data, which is just the northern sky.
Okay.
And so at TechFest from a year and a well, 2.5 years ago, we were working with Alex to take the images from SkyServer. Essentially, he has a tile server, which basically would, he had an image server, which would just give you an image of a particular section of the sky if you give it coordinates.
Okay.
As well as from that, you can also get other data about objects within that field of view, too. And if you go to skyserver.org, I think you can see what those kinds of services are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But for our TechFest demo, Jonathan Fay, developer, has been fiddling around with building his own hierarchical multi-resolution tile browsing engines over time. And so he quickly put together an engine that would pull the tiles from the images from Sloan, from SkyServer, and assemble them into this mosaic that you could sort of browse and zoom in and out on. And so that very simple 2D browser of images from the SkyServer was sort of the first sort of manifestation that I showed in a keynote at the TechFest in 2006.
Okay.
Six, yeah.
Okay.
And so at that point, by the time we were showing that, which was March, if I backtrack a little bit, there's earlier in the year before, I finally had finished this hardware software services platform that I'd been working on at Microsoft and finally felt I could spend some time and work on this astronomy idea. And so I told Jim, you know, we're going to do this, and we got some interest from Harvard from a talk I'd given at University of Chicago. Alyssa Goodman from Harvard said, you know, if you ever decide you want to do this, let me know because I want to help, because I think this is a really great idea to do this. And so she found an intern for us who was passionate about education and getting her working on her PhD in astronomy at Harvard. And so she came to work with us in the fall of 2006. And, you know, I had a whole string of emails going back and forth to Jim about, you know, we're doing this, we're finally getting started, we're building the two-mass sky image, et cetera, et cetera. And then in January, you know, I was emailing him more about sort of our plans and things. And then, you know, he disappeared. I'm assuming that your audience will know what happened to Jim, or I should go into that.
We can assume that people will know.
Okay. So Jim essentially disappeared after going out in San Francisco Bay to the Farallon Islands to spread his mother's ashes. And so when we hadn't heard what happened to him, you know, he'd still, this massive search was going on, and we still didn't know. So when TechFest came around about 3 or 4 weeks later, Jonathan and I decided we would rename it was called the Universe Project at the time, that we would rename it Worldwide Telescope in honor of Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And so that took us to the beginning of this project here.
Okay.
And then we started building it. That was in March. And I think later that summer, it was essentially this big effort to try and secure image sets and data from lots of different sources, as well as building the engine and finding the authoring environment. And we showed a rough prototype of it at the Astronomical Society of the Pacific meeting, I think. What was that, in Chicago?
Yes.
I think it was.
Yes, was it?
Yeah.
In Chicago.
And I think Roy was at the talk. And then, Roy, do you want to sort of pick up the story from there when we sort of first met? I think Roy had heard of the Worldwide Telescope Project from Alyssa.
Yes, I had heard about it before. And in fact, let me just rewind the tape on my end all the way back, because I was smiling when Curtis mentioned his childhood story of being interested in the stars that he couldn't see. And I had the East Coast version of that, of looking up in New York City and trying to get my parents to get a telescope. I would hound them until they finally got one. And when we took it up on the roof, of course, there was nothing to be seen.
It's just a little too much ambient light.
Exactly. We thought we saw one, but it was a plane. So I can just fast forward, and my career has been in science communication, and I was actually familiar with Curtis's work long before the Worldwide Telescope. And when I heard his talk in Chicago and at a couple of subsequent conferences, I had a big smile on my face, because I thought this really is addressing two of my passions. One is astronomy and what's out there in the night sky, and having this unified view of it. I could instantly see lots of uses for this new resource. But also, if I can just say this, the other part of that is the way in which it's been designed. And so as somebody who communicates science, I have always been interested in that, what I would call the learning interface,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the user. You know, it's not just about using the resource, it's about learning from it. And I think it's so beautiful that I relate to it on those two levels. One is what I can do with it, and the other is just as a piece of architecture, if you like, a piece of design, as a piece of learning, as a learning tool. I think it's just so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it was clear that there were lots of things that could be done, but frankly, it took a long time to see all the many things that can be done with it. And so I spoke with Curtis over the next few months, and we talked about various projects and so forth. And then when I had really used the Worldwide Telescope and got a sense of it, I realized what a great breakthrough it is. One is this sense of experiencing the night sky, seeing it seamless. It's true that all these images, in principle, are accessible one by one by the public, if you know what sites to go to and where to find them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, many of us in the field do that when we prepare curricula or museum exhibits or planetarium shows, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that is background. You just have to hunt for these images. But one of the problems is that then you see everything, you see the universe in a disconnected way.
Mm-hmm.
Once you go on Worldwide Telescope, you have that. You see instantly, oh, I get it. It's a different experience. I'm experiencing the night sky as it would be if you could look up with perfect vision, if you like. So
yes.
You can look out and you can look around.
And with complete contextual awareness.
Yes, exactly. And so there is this relationship to the night sky, and I think we take it for granted. I think we don't realize how important the night sky used to be hundreds of years ago. You know, we have these floods in the Midwest. We call them disasters. Well, disaster literally means against the stars. A catastrophe is the Greek for against the stars.
Yeah.
We say somebody is considerate, or, you know, they consider something. Well, that means considere. They're with the stars. They've looked at their astrological charts. You know, the Romeo and Juliet, the star-crossed lovers, and all. It's all through literature. It's all through the sort of common speech. Then you fast forward to modern day, and few of us have even seen the stars, let alone have that relationship. For me, that's number one. about Worldwide Telescope. It is really inviting us to take a long, hard look at the night sky again. Of course, you can do that through the Worldwide Telescope, but then you can go out to, and look at the night sky from your backyard or from a dark spot and have that dual relationship so that not only can you see the night sky, but you can go back on WWT and explore it.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to do at night. Of course, laptops create their own illumination, and so for many years, going back all the way, in fact, to the MS-DOS era, you know, I remember my first astronomy program actually ran under DOS, amazingly enough, and you know, I would take the laptop of that era out and in the backyard, turn it on, and use it as a guide. And this is the, you know, sort of latest and greatest incarnation of that. It's a wonderful way to guide your observation of the actual sky.
And from the educational point of view, just that fact of experiencing the night sky pays enormous dividends. For example, we've done a lot of research, and our department here has done research on what is it that students know when they graduate from high school about the night sky, about the universe in general. And we know that the majority of all high school students graduate placing the stars inside the orbit of Pluto. So,
come on, yeah, really?
No, that's true. About 52%, and that's based on surveys of thousands of students in 37 states. So it's not,
oh, geez,
not a local survey. And there are many reasons for that, but certainly one of them is this lack of good images of the sky. It's hard enough to see a picture of the solar system, let alone its context with the rest of the galaxy.
Yeah.
And that's one beautiful feature of Worldwide Telescope. You get a sense of where things are. We know, for example, that students think that galaxies are closer than the stars because they tell us the stars are just point sources, and no matter what your magnification in a telescope, they just remain points, so they must be very, very far away, whereas galaxies, whatever they are big, and so they must be closer. But if you go on Worldwide Telescope, you look at the Andromeda Galaxy, the nearest big galaxy to us, and it's the furthest thing you can see with your naked eye, you really get a physical feeling. You see all the stars in our Milky Way that are the veil of stars that we look through, and you really get a sense that the Andromeda Galaxy is vast and distant. So just that sense of experience, I think, will really help students just in these basics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other part that I find just in our field is so useful is this idea of being able to look at the universe in different wavelengths of light. Because, you know, we see only the visible light our eyes can see, but, you know, that's like listening to a symphony when you're listening to one instrument at a time. You can download a Chandra image, an X-ray image, the sky, but what's that about? You can't quite figure out what's going on, or one of the infrared images. In Worldwide Telescope, you can seamlessly move, you can cross-fade back and forth between images taken at various wavelengths. So again, you know, to use a musical analogy, it's like hearing the whole piece. You get to see, oh, I get it. I see the objects that shine in visible light, but I can also see things that are going on and emitting these other forms of light, which are important because most of the action in the universe happens at wavelengths of light we can't see.
Mm-hmm.
That's another great benefit to Worldwide Telescope. It automatically aligns these different images of the night.
So can you say a little bit about how that's accomplished?
I think one of the first challenges in doing this was, how do you register so many different surveys?
Yeah.
At a very high precision, so you can do that kind of cost comparison between
yeah.
wavelengths.
Yeah.
So there was some emerging standards from the National Virtual Observatory and yet another organization, which is the AVM standard, which is essentially providing meta tags of very high precision within objects to give some exact positioning and scaling and orientation for images in the sky.
So this didn't require new data to be collected. It was a pass that was taken over existing survey data to sort of annotate it with the tags that would enable this orchestration to occur.
Right. Generally, I think that data exists, but a lot of times when, like Hubble will make these beautiful press release images that they send out in color, those are really created for the public to use. And they generally have lost their metadata by that time because they've been processed and layered in Photoshop and all that.
Okay.
So a lot of these beautiful images that we want to put out for the public needed to get that data, the metadata, back in there.
Okay.
And sometimes those are composites of different images, different sections, of smaller mosaics of different, you know, like large objects like the Great Nebula Orion is many, many images of long exposures from Hubble across different filters to come up with that large mosaic. And so that image itself needed to have the metadata put in there to be used. It's, I think the source image is about 500 megabytes. So that image, even though it is technically public domain, they don't release the large image because it's way too much data for most people to download.
Okay.
And so they have released low-resolution versions of that image, but we have the full, you know, full-resolution image of that, the Crab Nebula, and other things in Worldwide Telescope because we can allow people to see the highest resolution of those images with Worldwide Telescope while not having the person having to download the whole thing.
So part of this was going back to sources that were, you know, as you said, sort of notionally available but not practically available because most normal people wouldn't have had the resources to acquire them. But also part of it is about some emerging standardization in how these data sets are described and
yes.
Okay. And so can you say a little bit about who's involved in that and how that's been going along?
Well, there are essentially the whole group in terms of NVO, and well, you can talk about NVO, about what that group is doing to establish common standards and common protocols and common metadata for these images so they can all be used by everybody. The AVM, VAMP standard, I think it's a Virtual Astronomy Multimedia Protocol or something like that, leading the charge for the mature annotation of imagery and other media within the context of the sky.
And there are presumably many uses to which those annotations are being put, not just, obviously, this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're just trying to create it so that, a common repository is available, but I think having that common metadata allow people to search and find a whole variety of assets based on some specific coordinates of things that they're looking for, other metadata that they're embedding within that standard. So we were one of the first guinea pigs that were going to be going out with the VAMP standard. And then I think Google joined a little bit later.
Okay. So I do want to find out more about the authoring aspect of this because I... Well, it's right up my alley. I mean, I'm a huge fan of multimedia and audiovisual tools for educational and training purposes. And, this is just a wonderful example of that. I was looking at what files get created when I author or create a slideshow. And it looks like what's getting created is an XML file with, some pretty readily understandable stuff in it, like coordinates and so to me that actually says two things, right? It says that Worldwide Telescope presentations can be created outside of the Worldwide Telescope using other tools, which is interesting. And it also says that the presentations that are created inside of WWT could potentially be played elsewhere in other environments, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the whole idea with the authoring and these guided experiences are, you know, I want to go back to the educational intention of Worldwide Telescope. You know, I spent a lot of years building sort of the first two components of learning. You know, that component is sort of instructional learning by bringing in subject matter experts to tell you about specific subjects, and then also to tell you about them in context. And I can give you examples of that. And you've probably seen examples from demos that I've done, but also sort of the self-directed discovery aspect of learning.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third part that I wanted to bring into this with the authoring side is sort of constructive learning, because there's always this sort of duality in learning, you know, instructive versus constructive, and we wanted to sort of incorporate all of that within this one environment.
And can you explain what you mean by constructive?
basically where a kid that doesn't know that much about astronomy can take tours from experts and really learn about a subject, be taken to places they're not aware of,
yes,
but then pause those tours and explore on their own. I mean, if you take a tour in Worldwide Telescope and it goes to different objects, you can always pause the tour, like you're pausing the tour bus because something is interesting. You can stop and get off, and at that point you can right-click, as I talked about, get more information about that. You can zoom in to places that maybe the tour didn't go into as deep because they had to kind of keep moving. You can see other objects that are in the neighborhood.
Yes.
But if you notice down below in the context menu, as you get to different objects, you can not only see that object in different wavelengths, but you can also see other tours that also intersect with that object.
Yes.
And that's a really important aspect of it for us in terms of the interrelationship of these guided tours. Because the goal is that as you start to see more and more guided tours within this space, if you think of objects as nodes or intersections, the more tours there are, the more opportunities there are to branch off and go follow individual threads of your interest when you cross over things of objects of interest.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, the goal is that eventually maybe we would see essentially a hypermedia web of learning so that we're, instead of hyperlinking between words, we're hyperlinking between stories and paths and ideas.
Yeah, and that'll include the things I may choose to make for myself. So if I make a little narrative about a part of the sky, then presumably the other context that surrounds the place I was interested in is available when someone else is playing back that tour, right?
Exactly. I mean, the idea, I think I said too, is, I mean, you know, if you take a tour, say, about stellar evolution, and you learn about how, you know, stars get formed from nebula, et cetera, and eventually end up different forms from, you know, supernova to other forms, that anywhere along the way, say you get to the planetary nebula stage, you go, wow, those are really pretty. What's going on there? And then you might intersect with a tour about different planetary nebula where you're sort of diving deep into that category, and you might get to one tour just about the ring nebula, the Helix nebula.
Yeah.
And conversely, you may come across it a different way. You're browsing in the sky, you see something very interesting about the ring nebula, and then you would say, well, oh, what are these things? And you can see other things that relate to categorical information about that type of object, which would then intersect with how, you know, things like planetary nebula fit into the grand scheme of where everything comes from.
Yeah. So Roy, what are some of the tours that you have made, and what are the ones that you haven't but really would like to make?
Well, we're working on two. One is a tour of black holes, and that's going to be used in conjunction with a national traveling exhibit that the Smithsonian is producing and will open next year in Boston and travel.
Mm-hmm.
3 years after that. And the idea is that visitors will have all kinds of experiences and explorations in the exhibit itself, in which they capture data, they can take images, you know, canned images, so to speak, but they gather, they make all kinds of observations and so forth, and then they can take their images and so forth home with them, and then they're going to have an experience going onto the Worldwide Telescope, and there'll be a tour that's based on some of their experiences in the exhibit itself.
Mm-hmm.
Another use that we're working on a tour of alien solar systems, of exoplanets, as they're called. These are solar systems beyond our own. There are, as you know, I'm sure, there are more than 300 stars that are known to have planets orbiting them. And using a small educational telescope, we have a network of five of these. They're called micro-observatory. Students in middle school and high school can take their own images and study these exoplanets. They can actually characterize them in surprising detail. They can figure out how large they are and how far away they are from their star and so forth. But we're finding, actually, beyond all the education, we're doing a tour of the exoplanets as a marketing tool, actually, to interest teachers who have never used the micro-observatory telescopes, to interest them in this particular astronomy curriculum. You know, you can make a brochure about something and send them a couple of images of the night sky, and that's nice, but there's nothing more exciting than having a tour in which you get a sense of the context, the depth of the sky, and where things are. And just that idea of seeing a sea of stars and realizing that you can zoom in on one of them and start to tell whether there's a planet around it and what it's like and whether it might have life. So that's a use, this sort of front-end marketing. I call it marketing, but there's no money changing hands. It's a use that we hadn't really thought of, but we realize it's just ideal for worldwide telescopes.
Do you think there will be a kind of a citizen science aspect to this?
I just jotted that down so I wouldn't forget. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that that's going to be a major use. You know, astronomy is it's probably the unique among all the sciences in that there are more amateurs in it than there are professionals. Amateurs have their telescopes in the back, and there are hundreds of thousands of them in the United States alone. But this is a third category. You've got the amateurs, you've got the professionals, but now Worldwide Telescope, I think, makes possible the blossoming of citizen science, especially given this flood of images that we're going to have in the next few years, where there will be more images than any researchers could ever look at. So you'll have images that have never been seen by humans, and,
right.
and that opens up a huge possibility.
So part of it's getting more eyeballs on, as you say, this flood of imagery that there really aren't enough eyeballs to examine. Potentially another part of it is that there start to be citizen-driven efforts in the analysis of the data. And so I wonder, for example, if SkyQuery is or, you know, will become part of the suite here so that people can actually start to ask questions, you know, like, how many fast-moving objects are there in this part of the sky, which is one of the queries that Jim wrote and described in his 2002 paper.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, I would love to see that because I think, you know, there are several ways that the public can make a big difference. I mean, one is, of course, to look for things, and, you know, there's the serendipitous discovery. There's the sort of guided discovery where we know, for example, from some of these NASA solar missions where we have so many images of the sun coming back that you can see comets that were never seen before. You can see them as they get very, very close to the sun because the sunlight is blocked out. And so ordinary citizens have made discoveries of comets that nobody knew existed. And you also see that in Mars, where we have more photographs of the surface of Mars than anybody can look at. So they've been assigned to school kids. You know, 1 square mile of the surface of Mars is yours, and nobody else has seen this. But I think we're seeing that we'll see that for the universe as a whole. But to me, the most important thing is what you just alluded to, which is this idea of asking questions that other people had not thought to ask, even the professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to me. You know, when you ask people, what's the volume of a black hole? How big is it inside? If you go on the web and you look at the standard, I won't mention any organizations, but you'll find answers all over the board, and none of them are correct, and they all are at odds with each other. I mean, there are questions that researchers just haven't gotten around to asking that many of the public will ask, and for a lot of them, we don't know what those are yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, I mean, not to be maudlin about this, but I was thinking the other day that, you know, there's all this wonderful technology that goes into the Worldwide Telescope, but in a sense, it's the modern incarnation of a campfire, because you sit around it and you trade stories and you look up at the stars. and you know that our organization has telescopes in Australia and in Chile and elsewhere. And when I go to those countries, I find that the native cultures have all sat around campfires and develop these incredible stories about the night sky.
Yeah,
so just to go back to that whole idea of the storytelling.
So what actually is then the collaboration mechanism? Like, I made a little slideshow and it got saved as a file on my computer. What's the story in terms of how these things get, you know, exported out to a place where people can discover them and they can be woven together?
Right. So the short story of that is, we're trying to encourage the development of communities around this.
Mm-hmm.
Sky and Telescope is forming one. Astronomy Magazine is forming one. And I think Mead, which is a telescope manufacturer.
Okay, so on one level, we have this unit of currency, which is, I guess, the WWT file, the thing that's created on your local hard disk when you make one of these slideshows. And as I understand it, that's a kind of an amalgam. It's a bundle of XML and some imagery for the thumbnails, right? And
yep.
And audio, I guess, if you had that as well. So
yep.
you kind of create this file, and it's a bundle. So I think probably in a lot of cases, those would actually want to live out in, you know, web namespace, right, where people could link to them. But I'm a little unclear on how that gets, if I just take that file that I made and I post it to the web and I hand somebody the URL to it, then they can just launch it into the program?
If they have that file on their computer, it will launch Worldwide Telescope and play it.
Okay. So if they download it off the web, and then it'll launch and play.
Right.
Okay.
I was talking to a storyteller from a local Snoqualmish Indian tribe, because they have, a lot of their history and culture has sort of been handed over from generation to generation just through stories. And a lot of their stories have to be about the sky. And I wanted to try and capture some of those just as examples of the kinds of things you can do. I mean, that's what the tours are in Worldwide Telescope. They're examples of what people can do with this. And I don't know if you know, but if you are playing a tour, you can pause the tour and then go into edit mode for that tour, and all of that is open. You can, you know, change the destination of where somebody goes. You can change the drop in your own audio, your own narration.
Oh, really?
Text.
So at that point, you basically forked the thing that you downloaded, and you're going to adapt
with
it.
Your interpretation
modify
it. On it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or add something to the end of it, or do what you want. It's very. It's just like show source, right?
Yeah.
Except it's easier because you have to know how to program.
No, it's really it's quite straightforward. Do you think that there's a need, I suspect that there probably is a need for some sort of universal player, which wouldn't require the full application, wouldn't necessarily require Windows, but would be a way to,
absolutely.
to play these things?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. We have a mini community of authors here working on black hole tours, and it's fascinating to see. There's some collaboration and there's some rivalry, and it's a question of looking over each other's shoulder. Well, what stories are you telling, and how, and who is the audience going to be? And I love it because it's really getting us to think. Who are our audiences, and what part of it is devoted to research, what part is about education, what part is just meaning making, and I assume that after we've all, we're all happy with our tours, that we can export them out to the rest of the world. There's nothing proprietary.
Yep.
So you'll see those merging of communities.
Right.
I want to bring up one citizen science story for you, and that relates to Galaxy Zoo, which is a website that allows the public to help the Sloan Digital Sky Survey categorize and tag the hundreds of millions of galaxies that were covered in the various data releases of the Sloan.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of those cases, a teacher from Amsterdam was looking at this one galaxy, and it looked really, really blue. And so she sort of reported back to the folks at Galaxy Zoo, is there something wrong with this image because the galaxy looks blue? It was almost kind of an ultraviolet blue, deep, deep blue. Anyway, so they looked at it, and they thought, they had never seen that before. They'd never seen a galaxy that was at that high energy of the spectrum. And so they had retargeted a very large array to take a look at it. And based on those results, they've now secured Hubble time to study that galaxy in great detail.
Huh.
So that's an opportunity where putting the data out there, letting average people look at it, dividing up the sky, having that feedback mechanism can really advance science.
Hmm.
Because when you think about it, when we start to get telescopes like LSST and Pan-STARRS and these other large telescopes that are going to generate, many, many, many terabytes of imagery and data about the sky every single night, it's going to be physically impossible for any one person or a small group of people to actually sort of see what's up there. And, image recognition is good, but nothing is as good as the human eye and the human brain yet.
Yeah, but what you've just said is also a fascinating point, which is that there's always going to be a limit to the capacity, and so some guidance on what to look for is really useful. And if someone's actually discovered something interesting, and that becomes the justification to expend the resources to take a closer look, well, that's beautiful. That's exactly the way things ought to be working.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of these telescopes are thinking about, okay, well, how do we make this much data available to people? And how do we make that accessible in a really simple way? And so they've had conversations with us about how Worldwide Telescope might be able to help. I mean, there are other things like NASA's very interested in how real-time data feeds from them might work with World Wide Telescope to not only allow science, but also to allow the public at the same time have action to mission, have access to mission data.
That would be, I mean, it's this is one of these situations where you start to think about what's possible, and you quickly realize there just are an infinite number of interesting possibilities, and it's going to be great to see how this plays out over the next couple of years.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much, guys. I appreciate your time.
Our pleasure.
And
thank you.
Pleasure.
It was fun. Yeah. Thank you, Roy, for taking
great
time.
Great. Thank you, Curtis. I've learned a lot. Things I didn't know.
Really? Like what?
Well, just some of the history and, you know, just little details in there.
Always fun.
Well, thanks very much, guys. Have a good day.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.